delaying the school count date to guarantee funding. Federal COVID relief talks at an impasse, plus no more utility shutoff moratorium, and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending August 14th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb and Republican legislative leaders want to provide schools with more certainty about funding for at least the first half of the new school year. Funding became a huge question mark last week after Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray sent a letter to schools warning them they could lose 15% of state dollars if they don't reopen to in-person instruction. State law normally restricts funding for virtual education, but Holcomb says amid a pandemic, he wants to ensure schools get what they need.
Alleviate some of the concern, some of that uncertainty about funding for our schools. They have done a yeoman's job, heroic work. I know it's been a Herculean task.
Holcomb wants the State Board of Education to delay the required count of students at every school until December. That would seem to ensure schools get 100% of funding for the first half of the school year. But any further certainty would require legislative changes. Holcomb says that conversation happens when the General Assembly reconvenes in January.
And we'll have the benefit of seeing where we are, you know, 4+ months from right now with COVID-19.
Outcry from members of the Senate Republican caucus over schools not reopening to in-person instruction casts doubt over the potential for that legislative change. How much of the funding problem will this really solve? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. I got my own name right. We're off to a great start. Elise Schrock, how should schools feel right now?
Honestly, I don't know that they feel any better than they did before this announcement was made. This is essentially not a long-term solution. This is a timeline adjustment. Dr. Woody Myers, State House Democrats, are calling for a legislative session, a special session, to address this immediately. By kicking the can down the road till December, the governor is just kind of opening up that debate further for the more extreme Senate GOP leadership to possibly affect this. They're clearly not on the same page. I'm not sure that there's any long-term certainty with this to back up his no new cuts promise.
Mike O'Brien, we've talked about the possibility of a special session a few times on this program as various groups have floated the idea. I think Attorney General Curtis Hill called again today for a special session of the General Assembly. But even if a special session were to be convened, maybe just to look at this issue, is there any guarantee that a permanent funding solution would be approved?
No. I mean, I think the governor deserves, Governor Holcomb deserves some credit for getting Rod Bray, Senator Bray, and Speaker Houston on the same page publicly, because they clearly weren't on the same page a week ago. And I think the Senate Republican caucus continues to want to push schools to do in-person classes. So if you call a special session, there's no one, you don't limit it to this issue. We've talked almost every week for the last four to six weeks about people calling for special sessions for different reasons. There's going to be another set of topics later down the list here that for people that are calling for a special session for those issues. So we're not going to go in and have a full-blown legislative session. And the unfortunate reality right now is there is not long-term certainty anywhere for people in their whether they're employed, whether you're a school superintendent who's trying to make sure that you're fully funded through the 2020-21 school year. The reality is we're trying to give them as much certainty as possible in the near term, and they have it. So they have it now between now and the end of the year, and they can revisit that decision at that time the legislature goes in January.
John Schwanes, if you're a school leader, how are you feeling right now?
I've probably felt queasy if I'm a school leader for the past few months, and I don't see any let up in the immediate future. I think Mike is right. There is just so much uncertainty here, and normally none of us would condone as was the phrase employed a few moments ago, kicking a can down the road. But in this case, that's sort of all I think we can do, because we don't even know the shape of the can entirely, nor do we know the terrain,
how long the road
of the landscape on which you know we're doing this kicking. So I think normally, again, delaying is not normally a smart course if you know that you're going to have to face something inevitable outcome at some point, might as well tackle it. But in this case, we don't know what the outcome is. Will this become more virulent? Will kids who seem to be largely immune to at least symptomatic versions of this virus at this point become more vulnerable? Will a vaccine that seems to, make headlines in some fashion every few days, will we actually see something materialize, and can it be administered to 350 million Americans in short order? We just don't know. And so I think probably this is about as much certainty given the circumstances as anyone could hope. So as a school administrator, I just want to call in sick at least until this is all resolved.
I don't think that's an option for a lot of them. Nikki, our education reporter, Jeannie Lindsay, talked to the Martinsville superintendent earlier today about this issue. And the superintendent told her that a problem with pushing back the count date to December is they will have to collectively bargain with their teachers without knowing how much money they are going to get at the school. So does pushing back the start date, especially since we don't actually know a lot of the technical details here, does that create its own problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's no good answer. I just want people to be clear. This doesn't provide certainty, and it is not a solution at all, because if they don't change that law, all that happens is then when they do their distributions for the second half of the year, they just give them less to make up. They just reconcile the two. So, I just want people to be clear that all they've done is push this past the election so it can't be used as an election issue.
Oh, I have a feeling it might still be used as an election issue regardless of when they push the date back. But U.S. Senator Todd Young says talks over another federal coronavirus relief package remain at an impasse. Congressional Democrats have been negotiating with the White House, as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he couldn't get agreement within his GOP caucus for a package.
Young says some of his priorities for the next federal relief bill include more support for the country's hardest hit businesses, telehealth, and child care. The Hoosier senator won't say whether he thinks President Trump's recent executive orders, including a payroll tax holiday, are legal, though he says they're not optimal.
Here again, it's a national emergency, by my reckoning, the president feels as though he had no other response.
Young says Democrats are to blame for the impasse, claiming they refused to agree to anything but the House's $3 trillion proposal. Yet Democratic leaders last week offered to come down by $1 trillion if Republicans met them in the middle.
Mike O'Brien, who shoulders the blame for this impasse?
Well, it's Washington, D.C. There's plenty of blame to throw on everyone, I guess. They've been negotiating for months. I mean, you've got both sides kind of pulling for their own agenda here. The Democrats did move, but they're also not moving on issues that Republicans wanted to see. And the president and I think Congress adjourned for the August recess now, and so they kind of just left town and left Donald Trump with the keys to go and by executive order hand down whatever stimulus he sees fits. I'm not sure Congress just surrendering their the say they had in this was optimal for them, but the president's stepping in and delivering the relief that he's supported and believes he has the authority to use to help the American people.
Elise, is this a pox on everyone's house?
Well, I mean, the problem with saying, the president's doing what he believes he can do is that the president has a tendency to think he can do more than he can. And these executive orders, there are flaws with them. There are flaws on whether or not they will actually do what he says they think that he thinks that they do. Again, I do think Mike's right when he says that, we have to do better to find consensus. I think you saw Democrats try to do that last week. They offered to come down as a compromise from spending. Republicans have the presidency. They have the Senate majority. You think that there could be a little bit more done within their own party to push this forward, but we're not seeing it, and it's unfortunate.
So Mike pointed out that both chambers went into their August recess. Now, I think they've said that if some agreement is reached, they would call their members back. But if not, they're not back until the middle of September. We're getting closer to an election here. Nikki, as far as how voters feel about this, do you think that they're just going to hold whoever their member is responsible, regardless of which party they belong to, or will they just be happy to blame the opposite party?
I think people are getting so frustrated that they're just going to be mad at pretty much everyone involved. And I think it's kind of a fair position for voters, honestly. And I do find it really interesting that Senator Young and other people are not willing to criticize this sort of unilateral executive fiat. I mean, these are some major issues he's doing with cutting payroll taxes and things like that. And I just can't imagine that the legislative branch of the government is okay with that. But I guess they are.
John Schwanes, are you surprised that we haven't had that there's been no deal yet?
I am surprised. And by the way, great points have been made all around, but I wouldn't probably refer to use the phrase a pox on everyone's house in this context. Just a note to the future. Strikes a little too strikes.
I don't know. I thought it was more apt than usual, but that was just me.
Okay. Well, you intended it then. Well, then congratulations. I'm surprised. I thought because you have such widespread suffering, such widespread economic uncertainty, usually that's the recipe for action, even in a recalcitrant Washington, D.C., where unity seems to be so scarce these days. And what intrigues me also is that many of the people who seem to stand the biggest chance of suffering, whether that's eviction, whether that's an inability to keep food on the table or receive adequate unemployment benefits, are people who ostensibly are Trump supporters in states, potential swing states, sort of, you might say, the disaffected portion of the electorate who have for years felt that they weren't getting their fair share, the non-elites, if you will. So I think those are the very folks who may suffer the most in the absence of any sort of a relief package from Washington. So I still wouldn't be surprised to see some sort of deal come out of this at some point before the election.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Congress and the White House enact another COVID relief package before the end of August? A yes or B no. Last week's question, we asked, is the state right to wait for more federal guidance before spending the majority of its COVID relief money? Only 19% of you say it's right to wait. 81% say it's time to open the checkbook. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, after this week, Indiana utilities will be able to resume shutting off service for unpaid power, water, and sewer bills.
The Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission says lifting the moratorium on disconnections could encourage people to arrange payment plans with their utilities, which would help utilities ensure reliable service. Right now, it says few people with overdue bills have. The agency is giving some Hoosiers more time to pay those bills, however. Wednesday, the IURC ordered state-regulated utilities to offer payment plans of at least 6 months for their customers. Late fees, disconnection fees, and reconnection fees have also been suspended until October 12th. But all of these mandates only apply to state-regulated utilities. Several small rural utilities don't have to follow the IURC's rules, and as of July, more than 11% of Hoosiers were unemployed. Customers having trouble paying bills are advised to contact their utility or Indiana 211.
Nikki Kelly, does this feel a lot like the rental moratorium discussion we had just last week?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the same. And at least, though, on the rental side, there is some money out there that is being put toward help for renters. Right now, we don't have that. I mean, other than the general sort of township poor relief, you know, there's no special federal dollars being, put out there to help people with their utility bills. you know, it's almost as if I wished we had, like, say, a pot of $1.4 billion sitting around to help, because I think it would be great.
Yeah, I don't know where you came up with that number, Nikki. There was an energy assistance program paid for by federal dollars, but that expired. They stopped taking applications for that July 31st. John, the rental moratorium discussion we had that last week, which expires today as well, the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, that discussion, this discussion, taken separately, they would both be serious problems. Taken together, are we facing a real angry electorate?
I think so, unless something changes dramatically for all the reasons I spelled out just a moment ago in the previous round of questions. So much uncertainty, so much suffering, with the opportunity for a whole lot more suffering to be served up between now and November. You know, in some of these, this is hyperbole, certainly, but it's almost as if you have government officials having a news conference saying, good news, we are providing free packing boxes and strapping tape to all of those who will be forced to move out of their apartments and their homes. I mean, great news, but it doesn't solve the fundamental problem. Again, hyperbolic, yes, but I don't think it's altogether off target in terms of the kinds of frustration that many voters feel because of this COVID-induced uncertainty.
Elyse Rock, one of the things that was included in the governor's utility shutoff moratorium up till this point was telecommunications and internet service. And we are now facing a situation where more and more schools, whether they're open to in-person instruction or not, are relying more heavily on virtual education for a lot of their students. Is this a recipe, quite frankly, for disaster?
Sure. And, you know, here's the thing about what COVID-19 has done. It has completely pulled the curtain back on a lot of Hoosier suffering that already existed. These types of needs did not just happen because of COVID. Yes, they have increased. Hoosiers were in need before. They'll be in need once we hopefully get past this. And a lot of states, a lot of Midwestern states, already have a lot of these programs already in place as basic consumer protection. So to think that this administration is starting to signal that these types of assistance programs, especially right now, have outlasted their need is false and, quite frankly, unmasks an absurd amount of privilege to think that just now people are in need of these services because of a pandemic.
Mike O'Brien, I feel like I asked the same question last week, but does the state quite simply need to be doing more here to help people?
I'll disagree with Elyse. I mean, clearly, I mean, there's a necessary and important focus on people who were living right on the line before, when things were, quote unquote, when the economy was good and doing well. There were still people that weren't doing well and weren't benefiting from that. I think Governor Holcomb's shown a willingness to, on the rental assistance side, to invest dollars and assistance in those programs. We'll see if something similar comes on the utility side. The problem with the utility side is if these bills just go unpaid, all ratepayers eventually will pay them. These rates are controlled by the state. These are regulated companies. But when you have these types of surplus or these types of deficits from unpaid bills, at some point they're going to have to go figure out how to make up for that. This isn't like free money you can just forgive, because everybody watching this is going to end up paying a share of it. And so the state along with the ratepayers have, or the customers have to start trying to figure out how they can get back to even. Or what kind of assistance they need to help them get there, and what does that look like? And hopefully further guidance from the federal government on that $1.4 billion in CARE Act dollars that they gave us and put a lot of strings on will be loosened up and allow them to spend money on these types of programs.
To be fair, Mike, though, I think on the rental side, if we have a bunch of people evicted, we're all going to pay for that, too, in a variety
sure.
of ways. Maybe not quite as directly,
right.
but we're going to
no
be paying for
it.
That, too.
That's
All right. The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus unveiled an expansive justice reform plan this week that reimagines policing across the state. The caucus hopes to advance the agenda in the next legislative session.
There are more than three dozen proposed actions, including bans on chokeholds, racial profiling and no-knock warrants, automatic external investigations when police shoot unarmed or retreating civilians, and requiring public hearings before police union contracts are renewed. Representative Cherish Pryor says the caucus also wants to expand law enforcement training on implicit bias, dispute resolution, and de-escalation.
Our goal is to make officer training more detailed, interactive, and inclusive.
IBLC Chair Robin Shackelford says the agenda does not include defunding the police.
We believe in reimagining the police. We believe in restructuring the police. But we do not believe in totally getting rid of law enforcement. We see the need for law enforcement in our communities.
Shackelford says she wants to see more action from Governor Eric Holcomb on justice reform. Holcomb said at the beginning of June he would create a to-do list on the issue, but hasn't said anything since.
John Tronis, by my count, there were around 43 individual action items as part of this justice reform plan. What percentage of that stands a realistic chance of being enacted?
Well, I think the caucus was smart in the way it approached this issue. We've seen folks around the country kick up quite a stir by suggesting to defund the police or to, you know, these dramatic changes that seem unnerving to a lot of citizens. This was a smart approach, I think, by taking that off the table, by basically offering up a list of proposals that people, it seems to me, would be hard-pressed to call radical when you're talking about additional training, when you're talking about transparency and oversight by independent citizen groups, the review of public contracts between public agencies and unions. That's not the stuff of anarchists and crazies, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails. So I think they've won a battle in terms of the staging or framing of the debate. What I think remains to be seen is how much bandwidth the General Assembly has to deal with issues beyond COVID-19 and the economic crisis that results from it. Now, obviously, because of some of the events that have grabbed headlines, certainly around the country, George Floyd's death and others, it will be an issue. I'm not saying it's going to be squeezed, pushed aside by COVID, but it's going to be a session, I think, unlike any others that we've seen. And the amount of time normally allocated for these other issues might be narrow.
Nikki, I'm curious about what John just talked about. Do you think that not because of what's been going on this summer, which has caused more attention to be shed on these issues than perhaps ever before, but because COVID-19 will still dominate so much of the debate in the upcoming session, do you think that makes it harder to get some of this passed?
Probably, but I think a lot of that might depend on Governor Holcomb getting involved, and we still haven't heard from him. He said he would hear by mid-August, and we're still waiting for his proposals. But if he remains governor and decides to get on board with a few of these, I think they would be more likely.
Mike O'Brien, I want to ask you for a kind of prediction here. Would you be surprised if more than a quarter, so more than 25% of this agenda, gets enacted by the General Assembly?
I haven't read through the list. There were some things. There are 10 or 12 or 15 items on there that I don't think are unreasonable. If you look around the country, bans on chokeholds, body cameras, things like that, transparency and police contracting, I think those are things that have been embraced by members of both parties. And so it wouldn't surprise me if you see that kind of list.
Elise, would it surprise you? What do you think is realistic to expect?
Well, I mean, given the current track record, I think while these proposals do seem very obvious and would be helpful, I think they could be politicized, and that's unfortunate. I think these are addressing issues that have gone on for a long time that are systematic, and they are just now hitting the greater white consciousness. So we're behind on this already. I would like to think that it would get passed. We saw Representative Cherish Pryor get a summons for misdemeanors bill passed with 97 votes in the House last session. That was great, but then it was sent to the Senate where it didn't even get a hearing. So, you know, these are items that absolutely must be taken care of. I truly hope they kind of put up and shut up on these issues from a leadership standpoint.
Well, finally, as people are encouraged to wear masks when out in public due to COVID-19, masks themselves are becoming something of a fashion statement. So what is your favorite mask that you wear out and about? Mike O'Brien, we'll start quickly with you.
Holcomb for governor.
on brand always. Elise?
Yes.
Anything that's made by my abuela. She's made like hundreds of masks at this point.
Nikki?
Definitely my Ohio University alumni mask.
And John?
Well, I stole one of my kids' IU student masks. Don't tell anybody. But when the next pledge drive rolls around, I'll dutifully switch to a WFYI.
There you go. All right.
I'm a company man, after all.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.